The Man Who Showed Us How to Take the World Apart by Daniel J. Wakin. I recall the lecture archaeologically digging beneath a quarter century of accumulated intellectual detritus in my mind as a kind of highfalutin entertainment, an embrace for the initiate, a co-extravaganza of pyrotechnics and puns and peculiarities. In a lecture room at the University of Chicago, Jacques Derrida drew an enormous circle on the blackboard. As he spoke, he dramatically added lines and curves, each signifying another form of textual interpretation, intersecting or glancing off the circle. A Venn diagram of deconstruction seemed to be taking shape. And deconstruction was, of course, Derrida's much vaunted interpretive method of making sense out of nonsense or vice versa. That diagram also turned out to be an enormous eye complete, if I remember correctly, with pupil and cornea. A cartoon. But the eye, Derrida explained, as if mentally winking in our direction, was really an eye, and the eye was how we come to see. Another cartoon, this time in words. Or was the point something else that I would be able to discern only by studying further, trying to pin down his mercurial weaving? And wobbling while juggling allusions to Rousseau, the Talmud and Heidegger. It hardly seemed worth the effort, because by that time, despite the presence of the charismatic figure himself, despite the fact that his work still carried the promise of esoteric knowledge, and that he had yet to reach his peak of influence in the American Academy, the seductive lure was gone. But what a lure it was! And how many still feel its pull? Now, with Derrida's death last week, and the promise of accumulating assessments and reconsiderations, I can almost summon up a bit of nostalgia for the initial encounter with the Algerian-born French philosopher's works, the thrill of learning his language, piecing together paradoxes, to get at his idiosyncratic vision, his eyes I hear as a writer of almost impenetrable obscurity, who nevertheless managed to overturn traditions in American literary teaching, see the postmodernist mod relativism. Redefine the acceptable limits for academic prose, and even give popular culture one of its most overused words, deconstruction. Derrida partly provided the thrill of sheer nerve, daring to write something that wouldn't just modify interpretations, but challenge the entire philosophical and literary enterprise. His was an imperial ambition, one inherited from Nietzsche and Heidegger: don't reinterpret, uninterpret. Show not just that some formulations are mistaken, but that all are. And that, moreover, they have to be. Show how all of Western thought is based on a type of ignorance or incompleteness, that everyone who claimed to get the point was missing the point. We have all learned that great works of art and literature may contain ideas and assumptions that their creators may not have been entirely aware of. There is the Freudian unconscious, the Marxist theory of superstructure, the learned dissections of metaphor and allusion in literary criticism. Who would be surprised to learn that things are seldom what they seem? But for Derrida, things can also never be what they say. Any attempt to explain or reason, or demonstrate, or communicate already contains the seeds of its undoing. Any statement must conjure up its opposite. Pay close attention and it becomes clear how much energy is being expended on pretending to make clear what really cannot be. Look even more closely, and there is always a small point in the text, a paradox, an unexplained word, a knotty phrase, that when properly probed can undermine the pretense, pull aside the curtain of ideology, and show what indeterminacy and uncertainty lie beneath the surface. There is a great appeal in this promise, because it is, in part, a familiar part of ordinary experience. We already know that all cannot be as it appears. Perhaps it is also the case that it is impossible to make a seamless system. Perhaps there is no way to tie up all loose ends. We know that this is often the case. Few human activities can be tidily organized by orthodoxies. Why not endorse a kind of radical suspicion, one that would be particularly useful in challenging traditions and orthodoxy? Such were the secrets and lures promised in Derrida's texts, a dizzying undermining of presuppositions. Take any received opinion, aesthetic judgment, historical analysis, or cultural activity, find its hidden premises, its unacknowledged preferences, its knots and feints, and its authority is undone. Applying this method to the works of the West, Derrida became a kind of prophet for counter-Western thought. He found his intellectual liberation by closely reading works by Rousseau and Levi Strauss. If these works could seem to break down the pretense of Western civilization, while heralding the virtues and values of a pre-civilized world, for Derrida they did not go far enough, they too embodied Western orthodoxy. But, of course, one reason for the extraordinary success of Derrida's ideas is that they also followed an orthodoxy in which rebellion is privileged over tradition and iconoclasm over authority. Independence is declared, obeisance is dismissed. This devotion to autonomy, accompanied by a spirit of play, is partly what gave Derrida a following in America far more enduring than that in France. His radical anti-authoritarianism and counter-Western ideas also gave him an empathetic reception on the international political left. But this orthodoxy, too, can be as ruthless and demanding as any other. This may have been why Derrida could often become mannered and puerile, endlessly turning rebellion on itself. And late in his life, Derrida, bristling at charges that he was a relativist, tried to find some sort of firm, unshakable ground upon which to stand a notion of political activity and justice that might justify his triumphant orthodoxy. To no avail. In the recent book, Philosophy in a Time of Terror, here is what he said about 9/11. We do not in fact know what we are saying or naming in this way, September 11th. The brevity of the appellation September 11th, 9/11 stems not only from an economic or rhetorical necessity. The telegram of this metonymy and name, a number, points out the unqualifiable by recognizing that we do not recognize, or even cognize that we do not yet know how to qualify, that we do not know what we are talking about. The rest is silence.